Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Our young look to the future with hope, but feel trapped by a history of failure. And so we pause to ask, how can we escape the trap of history? Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1150th edition of The Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Acordalia who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. And today we have some What's Eating What Radio. We're going to look into our future and to our past to see if we can find a way to escape the trap of our history and to realize the hope in our future. We begin by introducing our Food Chain Radio intern, Sophia Wilmore, who is shortly to graduate with a degree in environmental sciences with an emphasis in agriculture. Sophia, congratulations.
Thank you so much, Michael.
So, big deal. You're going to go out into the world now, right?
I am. I mean, I'm going to travel, take a little break, but then after that, I'll be out there.
And hit the program. Now, one of the things you always expressed interest in is the fact that you would like to work in agriculture, but can't figure out a way to see making it work. And
yeah.
A lot of the reason you feel a little bit trapped by history. Mm-hmm. And so that, of course, was your assignment to, as your last show as a producer, to produce your own show. And that's kind of the direction you wanted to go. Why is that?
I did. Well, I am a mixed woman, and I come from a background in agriculture. Not my family per se, but my education. I've always gone that route. So I was really interested in why, when I went out to a farm, I mainly saw white people working the fields. When I look back in history and I saw that slaves really were the ones working the fields. So I was wondering, what happened to all of the black farmers? Did it not carry over from slavery? That was my main question.
And so here we are.
And so here we are.
Okay, good. And today you've brought us some really exceptional guests
to help guide
the way, right?
Yes, and they were actually on a previous Food Chain Radio episode as well. So we're introducing Dr. Gail Myers, the founder of Farms to Grow. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Gail.
Thank you. It's great to be back, Sophia.
So can you tell us a little bit about what Farms to Grow is?
Wow, I'd love to. We are a small nonprofit that started out as an extension of my work as a graduate student at Ohio State University back in the late 90s. I interviewed African-American farmers in Ohio, and upon graduation, found that it was almost impossible for me to sort of walk away from the voices that I heard in the interviews, and moved to California in 2004 and co-founded Farms to Grow. And actually, after meeting people like Mr. Will Scott and hearing that the farmers here in California were dealing with the same tragedies almost that the farmers in California, that the farmers in Ohio and in the Southeast were contending with. So we started Farms to Grow as a way to do something. And we've been around for about 13 years, intervening, organizing, just being an advocate for African-American farmers and other socially disadvantaged farmers so that they can participate in the agriculture industry.
Oh, and what got you interested in farmers specifically? I know you're an anthropologist.
You know, it was somewhat of a serendipitous kind of a endeavor. I was having a conversation with my advisor about his work with Amish farmers. This was in August of 1997, and he asked me about black farmers, and I didn't know anything at that point, and did a literature search at the library after leaving his office, and was quite surprised and that the farmers at that time in 97 were dealing with a class action suit that had been brought against the USDA. It was called Pickford versus Glickman, and Glickman was the Secretary of Ag at that time of the U.S., Secretary of the USDA. And Mr. Pickford was the plaintiff who was proposing that there had been discrimination against him and thousands of African-American farmers historically. And eventually they won. About 10 years later, they were able to realize some benefit from the damages from that. But that's how I got involved, really just curious about it. And then after I began interviewing African-American farmers and finding out about their farming practices, realizing that they farmed very much of a sustainable agriculture, biodynamic, all the ways in which we had studied traditional agriculture, I found that those practices were still being adhered to present-day farmers. So I just got involved as a way to tell their story, honestly, and have been involved with our farmers since 21 years now.
Oh, great. Well, I can appreciate that. And we also have a farmer, Will Scott of Scott Family Farms. Welcome back to the show, Will.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
And can you tell us a little bit about Scott Family Farms? What do you guys do over there in Fresno?
Okay, currently I have about 40 acres that all of it is not under production, but we are slowly evolving where we can maximize use of the land. But we grow traditional plants, you know, usually crops that are in season. Like now, we got black-eyed peas, okra, tomatoes, and corn and stuff going right now. And then we transition, I guess, during the winter crops. You know, around July, we start planting the winter crops like the collard greens, mustard greens, spinach, turnips, and stuff like that.
So you specialize in southern specialty crops, right, which are traditional African-American diet foods.
that's very true, you know, and I think that, I guess to go back a little bit, you know, I guess you need to know about my background, too, is that I was born in Oklahoma. And my grandfather was a sharecropper, and therefore my father sharecropped with him. And I got on the tail end of it, you know. But also, the crops that I grow today are things that I was raised on then. You know, those things that sustained us and made us as healthy and strong as we are to do what we had to do. So, you know, when I come to California, you know, naturally those things came back to me. Yeah.
Wow, yeah, that's really great that you could bring that out here to California as well. So I want to start out with a question. And that question is, what is the history of black farmers in America? How did we get from slavery to food prisons, which are basically just areas where there is not any access to fresh foods and vegetables? So I want to ask you, Dr. Gale, what happened to all of the black farmers after slavery?
Wow. I don't know if a 30 or 45 minute show can answer that.
It's a heavy subject.
Not exactly a yes or no, right?
Yeah, and a whole bunch of research. Well, let me sort of give you the Cliff Note version, if I could. You know, with regard to developing this country, you know, when the Spanish and the French and the British came in and took the land from the Native Americans, they weren't able to grow the crops that were needed. It was an agricultural rich, you know, in the southern states. So through trial and error, the Africans were brought in to different parts of the Americas, from Brazil to Cuba to the Caribbean to South Carolina, to really grow this country. And you hear a lot of folks, and people are misunderstood by that. When black folks say we built this country, those were the days from the mid-1600s to the 1800s when the infrastructure, there was no infrastructure. Fortunately, the Native Americans had kept the land pristine. So to eke out several millions of gallons of a water system that became the South Carolina rice industry took a lot of ingenuity. And most of those Africans did that by hand with baskets.
Mm-hmm.
So they built the infrastructure. I'll just take South Carolina, for example, with the rice industry. And Judith Carnegie does a great job. I think this might have been her dissertation when she talks about Africans and rice in South Carolina. anyway, so with regard to that, the industry of rice itself, that money was shipped back to Britain and shipped back to different parts of Europe to mm-hmm. buy machinery and equipment and eventually begin to provide the infrastructure for the Industrial Revolution in addition to some other sources of revenue. But so those are the same people that you had mentioned earlier, from the history books you see in the fields.
Dr. Gale, we're going to have to...
Yes.
You're going to have to take a quick break, but we'll pick it up when we do come back. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Sophia Wilmore and you right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we have a guest co-host who is the Sophia Wilmore, the student producer of Food Chain Radio Program. She's graduating, going out into the world, but I gave her an assignment to pick a subject that really touches her, and she picked that subject, which is the history of black farmers in the United States. What happened to them? Where did they go? Why did they disappear? And the big question of all, Sophia...
Do I, as a minority, a person of color, have a reason to feel trapped by history, especially nowadays and looking into agriculture? So before the break, we were talking to Dr. Gail Myers about a little bit of the history of black farmers after slavery. And I just want to go back and just ask... Do we as colored people have a reason to feel trapped by history?
Wow. Dr. Myers.
Oh, a question. Well, I think, absolutely, historically, we can't feel any other way but trapped.
Mm-hmm.
But as history has also shown, the people who are most resilient are African
mm-hmm.
People. And so in spite of the trap, for example, coming out of the enslavement period, you would think that most of the formerly enslaved Africans would want to leave the South. But what happened is they began to put monies together and purchase the same land that mm-hmm. that several generations they had worked for free for, hundreds of years. And so the notion that they were doing what they knew, like Mr. Scott said, when they came from Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
So these were the people that stayed on the land. They bought farms, during the Reconstruction, and it was one of the golden era for black land acquisition from 1865 to the 1920s, which is when those 19 million acres of land that you read about in history was acquired.
Right.
Families put their pennies together and they work, and that's how folks were able to get out of the poverty
mm-hmm.
that had been laid foundationally through those years of enslavement. Moved to the north, purchased land, sent kids to school. Folks went on to different parts of the world. But it was those same hands that had worked those in bondage, eventually as they were free people, began to provide foundational communities, like here in Allensworth, California. Was a community started by Colonel Allensworth,
mm-hmm.
designed to be an all-black community. So yes, in many ways, we were trapped from legal laws and, from the skin that we were in and sort of the prejudices
mm-hmm.
that were inherent in the development of this country, but not by mentally believing that we weren't able to acquire and be equally adept at becoming full citizens in this country. And it was done through agriculture.
Yeah.
So I would encourage you, if you are very interested in farming or the land, that is the one industry from which
mm-hmm.
we were able to build blocks to come out, at least to see a little bit of level ground. I think that being able to participate fully is certainly beyond each of us and our individual selves. We're going to need to rely on a government that, you know, is really all about presenting mm-hmm. all of the benefits to all of the people. But until that happens, we can still fully participate in the ways in which we've done historically, coming together as a community, pooling resources, believing in the good of the community. You know, capitalism is the thing that was the undoing, but what you see in black communities and with black farmers in particular, there was a very community, communal approach to farming. It's the same traditional agrarian values that you see in most communities, in Latin American communities, and Asian communities, folks coming together. It's the same thing in African communities. And that's how we were able to survive, mm-hmm. putting our resources and our time and our love and hope together.
And Mr. Scott, you know that really well as well. You said your family were farmers. They were sharecroppers. Do you feel that we're currently trapped by history? Do you see that in your field?
Well, I think so, too. And also, it's a mindset, too. But if you would look at the whole situation that, you know, without slaves, there would have been no slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Without slavery, there would be no cotton. And without cotton, there would be no Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And without the Industrial Revolution, the United States would be just another European colony, you know.
Also, if you notice that after Emancipation Proclamation, you know, you had a lot of unemployed people. And we had two great statesmen, Booker T. Washington and Dr. John Washington Carver.
Hello, Mr. Scott. Have we lost you? How about you, Gail? Are you there? Looks like we
I'm still here.
We still have Gail, but we don't have Dr. Scott.
Mr. Scott.
Hopefully he'll come. He'll call back in.
Yeah, he'll check back in
Mr.
with us.
He's got a wealth of knowledge.
Oh yeah.
And you know what? He has a great radio voice too.
Yeah, he does.
Yes, he does.
So.
Oh, he's calling in.
He is calling in. Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. Go ahead.
Dr. Gail Myers, we were talking about how slavery has really impacted black farmers, and it mainly modern day black farmers, because it's pretty obvious that the people of the past were impacted by slavery, but it's been so many years since slavery now. How are we still being impacted by it?
Okay, are we back? Well, I was cut off for a minute.
But we got you back, Dr. Scott. Hold on. We'll let Gail answer her question and come back to you.
Okay.
Well, I think, you know, from the work that I've seen in talking to the farmers, you know, within the last year, the same belief in you know, the folks that when they go to apply for a loan, for example, mm-hmm. as a result of the Pickford, you would think that it would be easier for these farmers to get loans and the type of resources. There is some relief, but by and large, these farmers are still not getting the kind of relief that they could possibly get from some of these agencies. So that piece still remains.
So you're talking about that systemic discrimination from the USDA that's still going on.
From a lending perspective. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of folks in the USDA that have done a great job to clean up, I think, the agency. And I think, you know, what undergirds this whole notion is, you know, this belief that black folks don't deserve to be fully participating in the American quote-unquote dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of that drives the people that are in the office, not that it's institutional, but you got folks occupying these positions that may act like that individually, you know, so they could make the whole office look, you know, not its best. But the other piece about that is the structure of U.S. agriculture, the nature of it is that you got to be able to have a distribution outlet. You have to have a huge amount of acreage supply chain.
Dr. Gail, can you hold that? We're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, all those pieces that we have to put together to be successful, this is The Food Chain. Sophia Wilmore, co-pilot today, right back. Do stay tuned.
Bum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
What happened to the nation's black farmers? That is the question on the table today being placed there by Sophia Wilmar, who is a graduating senior at the University of California, going out into the world, has a degree in environmental science and a minor in agriculture, wondering where the future is for black farmers. Looked at the history, found it to be truly amazing, but then that history disappeared and we're looking for it. So we're talking with Will Scott of Scott Family Farms. Go ahead, Sophia.
So we were asking Mr. Scott his own personal history. He mentioned that his family came from sharecroppers, came from farmers. And we left off with Mr. Scott talking about the Industrial Revolution. Mr. Scott?
Okay, yeah, well... When this happened, like I said, then after the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, you had all these unemployed people. And that I mentioned about two states, black states, that we had Booker T. Washington and Dr. George Washington Carver. One advocated casting down your buckets where you are, you know, and you know, make a living. One advocated education.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as you know, that those that did sell back, some of them went back into the same condition that they got out of, you know, more or less back into slavery and now back into the sharecropping.
Mm-hmm.
But also, too, that education was the one that appealed to most people, because if you've been denied access to books, you know, education is something you desire. So most of my culture, you say that we'll go out, we'll bring ourselves up by getting education. And that's what most of them did. And that also due to the fact that the legacy of slavery, where you didn't get paid, you know, so you get education. And this is what I was advised to when we came to California out of Oklahoma, is that my mother was both my parents were pro-education about getting education, get you a good job so you can make some money, take care of your family. And I think that this is probably went throughout our cultures, that education was the one that was a way to make yourself, more sustainable. And you get away from farming because it didn't pay.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's something else that played a crucial mark in that, too, is that Jim Crow laws, you know, that denied blacks ownership of land.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at Field Order 15, that's what Sherman came through, is that those slaves were supposed to be given 40 acres and a mule. You probably hear that quite often.
Oh, yeah,
you
yeah.
know? Well, some of them did it, but not, most of them didn't, and those who was given it, they called the carpetbaggers, came down, and they worked in conspiracy with the Southern, you know, and they took this land from these people. So not having access to land, you know, it prohibited those who wanted to farm from farming, you know. And as you, mm-hmm. Move on up through life, that's why the lawsuit was filed against the USDA, because there was unequal treatment, you know. And so as it is now that, you know, we have a, we were trying to undo some things, because this food production business, it should be an all-hands participation. That means that all ethnic groups should be concerned about the not only the quality of food, but the availability of food.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This was part of my organization, African-American Farmers, is that we'd like to go back and kind of bring some young people on board with a new mindset. Instead of saying farming, we use the up-to-date word agriculture, because agriculture comprised more than, say, digging in the dirt and planting seeds. There's
mm-hmm.
some other associated things with agriculture, and we try to get them in that respect. But
Sorry, Mr. Scott, you're saying also that you feel that young people really need to get into farming to perhaps perpetuate the knowledge that is being lost. Mm-hmm. With black people not going into farming, how do you feel about that? Do you think that there is some degree of knowledge that's being lost with farming when black people don't go into farming?
Exactly. You know, that, you know, you are what you eat. So, you know, and some of the maladies that we are experiencing with our young people, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes,
mm-hmm.
those are happening to people that are younger age. Those are supposed to be old people's disease, you know, but it's because of the food that we eat. So, naturally, we need to get young people back in, because they can take, you know, I come from the elementary way of doing agriculture. But now, you know, with this new technology, and these young people, they fit nicely in it, because they know this new technology. And they can take what I know, you know, to another level, where they can still produce this food not only quality food, but also be participating in that. Say in California, you know, it's a $1 billion business.
Mm-hmm.
But there's hardly very few blacks participating in it because, you know, they want to have a tendency to associate it with slavery. Like I said, they don't have the baggage that I have, so they come in with a fresh mind, you know, and they can look at it from a new perspective, as far as not only with getting the niche crops, but also being able to sustain themselves as far as being compensated for their effort in that field, you know, in this field.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, it's tough. But I see some really smart young individuals out there who that actually, once they get into agriculture, find out that, yeah, part of it is actually work, but also there's a pleasure from it, you know, and that's why I got back into it, too. I obeyed my parents, got education. You know, I was an engineer with the telephone company, I retired, but if it's in your DNA, you know, you want to come back, you know, and fulfill whatever mission that you were put on this earth for, you know, and I contend this is that each individual is born has a mission on his earth. He has to do it. So the sooner you get back to it, you know, the better things are. And I think the young people, they're ready, you know, because this new technology, they kind of inquisitive. How can they use that and apply to, you know, providing food for us, you know, not only food, but health-wise also.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a huge transition that needs to be made, is it not? You have to convince the young that agriculture is a technology and an industry in which there's boundless opportunities when they think it's farming and something that slaves did. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're having a guest co-host today, co-pilot the plane, Sophia Wilmore, graduating from the University of California. We're going to pick it up when we come back. Do stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, how do we get the young people back in agriculture? That's the question we left off with, and so let's pick it up with Sophia Wilmore, looking at the history of black African-American farmers in the United States, seeing it as kind of a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
Is it not? Mm-hmm. Is that how you see it, Sophia?
I do, in a lot of ways. I think that it's a tragedy, the knowledge that's being lost when black people don't go into farming, when their ancestors spent so much time farming, and not just farming, but farming sustainably, because those are the only ways that we had to farm back then. So I wanted to ask you, Mr. Scott, you were talking about before the break how we need to get more young people into farming, and I agree with you. I think that that's important, especially for carrying on the knowledge of farming. How do you think that we can get more young people into farming and share that knowledge?
Yeah, like Sophia Wilmore, for one. How do we get Sophia back on the farm, Will?
Well, I think that, you know, organizations like what we're trying to set up, you know, the African Farm, we have a demonstration site that where we can take people from, you know, land preparation through planting, cultivating, harvesting, and also the business aspect of it. Now, we're very fortunate that we have had a community organization that came to us. You know, and I don't know if you heard about the Sweet Potato Project.
Mm-mm.
You know, I think it's going from one end of the state to the other, but they started a program with us providing the land for them and some of the consultation, you know, consulting. And they had a project, it's been 2 years now. But what it does is that this year we have about 30 young people, you know, young ladies and young men who are out there. Like yesterday, they took the transplants, you know, and put them in the soil, you know, and getting them ready, you know, to grow. And then they'll take care of them, keep the weeds out of them, you know, and they'll learn step by step, you know. And then when they get to the end of the harvesting, they'll learn the harvesting part of it. And what they've did is that they've taken it one step further. So I said these young people have a lot of technology intelligence,
mm-hmm.
you know. So what they did, they put that value added to it. They took these yams, I call them yams, but they call them sweet potatoes. But they took sweet potatoes, you know, and they started making products out of them, which they sold.
Mm-hmm.
And this year they saw that, you know, not only the harvesting them of them, but they're getting to the marketing aspect of it too. Is that who do, you know, once I grow this crop, who do I sell it to, or who, you know, am I on the contract with?
You're marketing farming as being an educational experience, and that's kind of how you're roping people, younger people, into the idea of farming. Is that sort of what you're doing?
Exactly. See, now, you know, you have to look at a broad picture, too, is that we live in a world that's run by money, right?
Oh, yeah.
We live in a country where we worship money, you know, so therefore money plays an important part in it. So when you're talking to young people that we have taught from the books, you know, they want to know, we call it the bling bling, you know, do I make money and how can I make money and what is the bottom line?
Mm-hmm.
So once you take them through this process, you, at the end, you need to know that, you know, let them know that they can make some money and it's up to them.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the business sense, you know, like yourself, so you went through the educational system now that if you were to come to a farm and you learn what the processes are, you could take it to the next level because you can say, okay, doing this, this is how you get compensated. This is how you can make money, you know, and this is how you can make a lot of money because, you know, you know something about the Canadian community, but where do I sell this stuff and who do I generate some kind of connection with in order to take care of the end product, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And
these young people, like I said, they're smart. They know the book stuff, but they just don't have
the practical knowledge, yeah.
Right.
And Dr. Myers, I kind of want to ask you the same thing because you have an anthropological perspective on this. How do you feel we can get more young people into farming, and why don't you think young Black people aren't quite as interested in farming?
Well, according to the census from the 2012, there was a 12% increase in African American farmers. And it looks like I saw a statistic that about 70% of those folks who are African American were first time farming. So it does seem that we have young folks that are coming back into farming. So we'll keep our fingers crossed that that continues. And a lot of those folks are getting into, I know one in particular is in aquaponics and microgreens.
Oh, interesting.
So they're getting into the more market-based technology. And so they're seeing a future there. Like Mr. Scott said, they're using technology. But we do need to make land more affordable for young people because it's very prohibitive unless you have a relative or you have a small plot yourself. It's hard to get land, get equipment, and all the other inputs. And then the risk insurance, all the things that you need to make sure that if something happens, you don't lose everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then where are you going to sell it? So there's a whole chain that a lot of farmers don't have access to. But I say, you know, going back to the local community is a really good market, making that value chain connection with the local folks. And so I do think that there's going to be more young people that are going into farming. You'll see a lot of them in the urban areas taking up these farm and permaculture classes. And, yeah, I think at some point it'll reach, more of a critical mass.
That's a good news because we need to eat. And we need farmers to grow the food. So we have a few minutes left. We're going to turn the tables on Sophia Wilmore here. And I'm going to have our guests, who Gail Myers, founder of Farms to Grow, and Will Scott, Scott Valley Farms. Here's your opportunity to ask a young person with a lot of smarts what it will take to get her into agriculture. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host with co-host Sophia Wilmore, and you do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we have a few more minutes, but the question, you know, can probably go on for hundreds of years because it has. What happened to the Black farmers of the United States of America, soon to be graduating from the University of California with a degree in environmental studies and in agriculture? Sophia Wilmore wondered what happened to that rich, beautiful, wonderful history of sustainable agriculture grown by people with Black skin from Africa. What happened to them? Where did they go? So that's her question on the table to Gail Myers, founder of Farms to Grow, and Will Scott from Scott Falmy Farms. But I thought I'd turn the table on Sophia and ask Gail and Will if they have any questions for her as she goes out into the world. Gail, let's start with you.
Well, I'm always interested in how farmers relate to the land and the community. I'm wondering if, Sophia, have you thought about that relationship that you will have to land as you become a farmer, as a steward of this land? And what's that food that you're growing? How do you feel like that's going to connect you to community?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. And I've always sort of had a hard time with the idea of community in general because no one around me has ever really looked like me. So I think that that being a younger person and going to a farm nowadays, I mostly see people who don't look like me. And so it's never really seemed like my place to be in the farming industry. But growing food and giving it to my community, regardless of who's in my community, builds a stronger connection to the people around me. And so I think that, you know, just having something to give to others and knowing that that is sustaining them makes me feel good enough about growing food.
Wow. Will Scott, would you have something for her?
Well, also, too, that, you know, not that you are kind of interested in getting into it, is that, you know, how close to the saw would you like to get?
How close to the soil do you want to get?
That's an interesting question.
Dirt in the fingernails? Dirt close?
You know, I love growing food. I love working with the land and on the land and for the land. And I think that it does bring about a special connection. But learning about agriculture from an educational standpoint, I see so many problems with agriculture, just like the industry of it and how hard it is to get enough land to grow food on, enough, to actually be able to provide and like you were saying, Mr. Scott, actually make some money, because I do want to have a livelihood and I want to be able to create that for myself. So I think that right now, the way that I feel about it is I'd love to go out and be on the land, but I think that I'll likely be some kind of soil scientist or someone who does something.
Kind of trapped by history.
By history, yeah.
Well, see, that's what I was alluding to, and that's refreshing to hear, too, because when I say, you know, get close to the land, because I think, you know, you already know, you have an idea of what's wrong out there.
With that, we just ran out of time, but I want to thank Gail Myers, founder of Farms to Grow, Will Scott, Scott Family Farms, and Sophia Wilmore for joining me for a quarter. Best of luck to you, girl. Go out there and kick some butt.
Thank you.
And thank you all for tuning in. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Your host, as always, Michael Olson.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.